7th of October, 2005, Victoria, B.C., interview with Admiral Robert George. Today is the 7th of November, 2005, Victoria, B.C., interview with Admiral Robert George by Louise Walton. Sir, can you just, for the record, state your name, place of birth, current rank, and position within the military?
Yes, my name, as you said, is Robert Earl George, and I was born in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, 6th of October, 1940, and I retired from the Canadian Forces in the rank of Vice Admiral, and at that time, I was the Canadian Military Representative to the NATO Armed Forces Council in Brussels, Belgium. Prior to that, I had been the Deputy Chief of Defense Staff, and just before that, Commander of Maritime Command, during which time the Persian Gulf War occupied a lot of my time.
During the summer of 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, could you describe or give a brief description of your duties and responsibilities?
Yes, at that particular time, I was the commander of Maritime Command based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I had been in that position since the previous summer of 1989. So I was into my first year in command of Maritime Command, which was charged with the provision of operational maritime forces for the Canadian Forces for operations as required by the Government of Canada.
Then you must have been aware, leading up to the Iraq invasion, of the various media reports on the status of the Canadian Armed Forces, both positive and negative. Do you feel that this coverage is accurate? Why not, if you have any specific
reason? Well, I won't argue with the accuracy, because I think in a way the Navy had set its own trap on this. We had for years argued the case for modern maritime forces, and as an example, we used the state of our existing forces, which in fact we used to say were older than the sailors, soldiers, airmen and women that served in those forces. So we had put a case forward and successfully argued the requirement for updated destroyers as well as new frigates to replace the aging steam destroyers. So when the Navy was called upon to provide some operational forces in a theater that was less than benign, I think it was probably quite natural that the media and the public would say, hey, wait a minute, you've been telling us these ships are old and incapable of meeting today's threat, and on one hand saying that, yet now we're hearing that they're going to be sent off to what could become a war in the Persian Gulf. So we had made the case based on aging equipment and out-of-date equipment that the public was hearing. So it should be no surprise that the media picked up on that. And in fact, as we'll go on in this interview, I'll discuss how that was picked up not just by the media, but by retired personnel as well.
With this in mind, when and why did it first occur to you that Canada might send ships to the Persian Gulf? And in what capacity did you imagine the ships would be used?
Now, we had spent the summer watching various activities in Iraq and the movement of forces back and forth towards Kuwait. And the actual process of determining whether Canada might participate in such an action or not wasn't occupying our minds fully during the month of July. In fact, the whole year that I had been in this stage in command of Maritime Command, had been spent under great pressure to reduce expenditures in the Navy and in the Armed Forces in particular. So our whole focus had been on preserving our operational capability in the face of massive cutbacks in the defense budget. And you will recall that in 1987 there had been a new white paper that was going to provide the Navy with nuclear submarines, updated capability that, as it turned out, was much richer than the government could afford. And so we had spent the whole of the early part of 1990 going back and forth to Ottawa, looking at options in terms of how we were going to have capable forces, operational forces, under a very restrained budget. So as we led ourselves into the beginning of August, in fact, I had been with the Secretary of Defense of the United States for a number of days, and I had observed his preoccupation with staying in touch with Washington. And it was only in the early days of August in 1990 that we realized that Saddam Hussein, in fact, was intent on occupying Kuwait, and therefore there was some international reaction that was necessary. In fact, I think any headquarters, whether they're maritime or air or land forces, have to be constantly watching the political scene, the international scene, and asking themselves, what if? And I think partly that was going on both in National Defense Headquarters and in Maritime Command Headquarters during this period, although nobody was focusing on the exact requirements or how we would in fact answer a call if Canada was asked or encouraged to participate in some international activity that in response to this invasion of Kuwait by Iraq.
Okay. When it was decided we were going to send contribution with the international force, what are some factors that you were aware of behind the decision to send the Navy as opposed to the Army or Air Force?
The ability of the Government of Canada to respond to international crises is a interesting one when one looks at choices of either sending air forces or land forces or maritime forces. The advantage of being able to send the maritime forces is that, first of all, it allowed the Government of Canada to make a decision to send forces. The forces themselves, because of the nature of the distance from Canada to the Persian Gulf, would not appear there tomorrow. So just by virtue of making that decision to send maritime forces showed some international resolve on Canada's part. And even after they had been dispatched, it was still a matter of weeks before those forces would actually be in the operational area and be forced into either taking an active role in whatever activities were going on there at the time. If it had been air forces, one might argue that they could have been dispatched within a number of days without the benefit of having forward operating bases established and roles established. And similarly, to move land forces, they occupy space on the ground in a foreign country. And to be able to send maritime forces who would be present in the area but not necessarily in somebody else's country gave the country some flexibility in, first of all, showing its resolve, but B, not requiring a full commitment on, as we will explore, what particular activities, where they would be done, and at what time. So I think these were considerations that were being looked at when the government was faced with the decision of sending forces. And from what we knew at the time, it seemed to fit with the activities of our allies in deciding to go there and be present in the area to show a show of force and a willingness to become further involved. At that time, hopefully, that Iraq would withdraw from Kuwait. And as we saw, it took more than just the presence of maritime forces to force them into doing that. But this seems to me to have been a way of making a commitment, but still allowing plenty of time to refine that commitment in the eyes of both the government and the nation as a whole, because the government depended on public support in carrying this out.
In my research into this subject, I came across the warning orders that the deputy of CDS gave on the 9th of August, 1990, in which he alerted the CF senior commanders that a possible intervention in the Gulf under the codename Operation Friction was imminent. Keeping in mind what you just said, the notice of sale was 7 days with a three-ship naval force. What were your initial thoughts on the feasibility of the Navy's ability to meet this challenge?
There was certainly, based on what I just told you about our state of our maritime forces, had been discussions about what was required to upgrade those forces so that we had some comfort level, recognizing there was a risk involved. In facing that risk, we had to minimize that risk and have confidence in what we were doing was going to work, and that what we are setting out to do would be achievable in the time frame that we had. And realizing that in the end I was accountable for the success or failure of this initiative. And I think that as we unveiled the challenges ahead of us, it was something that we were lucky in some ways, and in other ways we were being faced with an opportunity that some people would say was insurmountable. I referred to our shipbuilding programs earlier. We were fortunate that at this stage we had our frigate program underway. We had equipment in Canada for those ships that we thought could be made available temporary nature for this task group that was deploying to the Persian Gulf. Nobody in the past had ever thought that we could actually sit down, determine the installation procedure and the timetable and the trials that would be required after installation, the training that would be required after installation, and get that all done before the ships would sail at the end of August or the 24th of August, as it turned out. So it was a huge, huge effort. And there were those out there that said that being unaware of what we were thinking of, that the ships were incapable of coping with such a threat as envisaged by the public in the Persian Gulf. So we had to convince, we had to be assured that this task we were taking on was doable. And in many ways, it ignored the time-tested routines that we had established over the years about making proposals on changes to ships, going through engineering processes in both in the command and then following that with processes in Ottawa, followed by with long acquisition processes. As an example, I recall one case where the dockyard was given the job of installing a new radar scanner on the upper deck of Protector, and the shop foreman went down and on the back of the cigarette case sketched out the requirements for the actual apparatus that would hold the radar scanner, and went back to the shop and had it built. Now that happened in an afternoon, and if you can imagine that kind of work being passed out to the establishment under normal circumstances, it would take months. And although we're not going to talk a lot about the involvement of the air, but the maritime air was one of the key elements of our activity. They too went to great lengths to upgrade their systems, but they brought engineers down from Ottawa and sat them around a table in Shearwater and went through all of the requirements that would normally take months, in some cases years. So these were the sort of things going on in my mind about how we could achieve some of these milestones, especially at the very beginning. As the days started ticking by, we saw how rapidly the progress was being made. I think the comfort level increased significantly, and we could see that what we were trying to achieve was going to be achieved and done in record times with superhuman effort from everybody, from dockyard mateys to families of dockyard mateys that brought food to them in the middle of the night because they were working all night on the ships. And all of those things added up to success in the end.
Can you think of anything that our Navy had or was particularly strong at that gave it a particular advantage over the navies of our allies in preparation for deployment, with the communications experience, things of those nature?
Well, certainly the kind of operations that the Canadian Maritime Forces had been doing for 50 years in terms of the Cold War and the threat at sea, both subsurface, surface, and air, gave the Canadian Navy very strong capability in surveillance and developing pictures of both subsurface, air, and surface pictures. So, to move that into an operation, as it turned out, in the Persian Gulf, trying to ascertain the presence of every vehicle in the operating area and what it was doing, where it was going, who it was, I think was done masterfully by the Canadian team out there, and I attributed a lot of that to just the backgrounds that they had in years and years of keeping track of what's happening in a particular area at sea. So that certainly was a great attribute. I think also what we had, this was a coalition operation. We had strong ties with United States Navy. In fact, we were, I think, in terms of an advantage, we knew personalities in the States and the the admirals that were in charge of the operations were admirals that I had worked with previously in the Pacific and in the Atlantic. And it made that communication between our services much simpler. And certainly one of the aims of our maritime forces for years had been that of interoperability with our allies. And that interoperability paid off as we brought together navies from all over the world for this operation. And that is probably one of the biggest strengths we had that gave us an advantage. And I won't say that some of our allies didn't have it as well, but it certainly was a comfort level to us.
During the preparations for the deployment of our Canadian task group, the Canadian War Council was formed. Can you describe for me the motivations why it was formed, and how did it fit into the larger picture of Canada's involvement in the Persian Gulf?
Well, when the first deployment was announced questions started rising about where and what the Canadian Maritime Forces were going to be doing, the decision had been made to operate the forces outside the Persian Gulf in a surveillance role in the way of determining all of the surface activity in and out of the Gulf. And subsequent to that, and as a result of discussions in the Persian Gulf with the commander of the task group at that time, and recognizing some of the requirements of the Allied forces, it was proposed that we move our operations into the Persian Gulf. I know this was of great concern to the cabinet in terms of our increasing risk. And when that role change had been suggested or proposed, in Halifax I tasked the commandant of the Maritime Warfare Center, who at that time was Captain Dumble, to do an assessment of Canadian maritime capabilities versus the threat. And as a result of that assessment being done in Halifax at the Maritime Warfare Center, I was able to recommend to the CDS that the operational area inside the Persian Gulf be accepted as one with a minimum amount of risk considering our capability. And I know that the CDS, then Chief of Maritime Doctrine Operations Admiral Anderson, were involved in briefing the cabinet to give them a level of comfort concerning the maritime forces' capabilities. And the change in operating area that had been put forward following the original idea that the maritime forces would operate outside the Gulf in a lower threat environment. And in that way, I think it showed that the cabinet was fully aware of the capabilities and what they were being asked to agree to. And I'll remind you, at this particular time, cabinet was also engaged in the Oka crisis. And rightly or wrongly, frequently the media chose to try and build some linkage in thought process between the land force operations that were being conducted in Quebec at the time and the maritime forces operations that were being agreed to in the Persian Gulf. I mean, for example, a rule of engagement, and trying to compare the kind of rules of engagement that were being agreed to for the operations in Canada, comparing those to the operations in the Persian Gulf. And the attempt, certainly the statement by the Defense Department that there was no linkage between those kinds of agreements to levels of force that could be used, for example. I had also seen as obstacles in this whole deployment, and I talked about the challenges of the trials and putting this equipment together for the ships and the aircraft, but one of the obstacles was building political confidence. And that building of confidence, I think, had a couple of aspects. One was obviously directly in front of cabinet, explaining to them what and why and how we were going to achieve these tasks. And that task was taken by the CDS, General Chasselin, and Admiral Anderson, who was his chief of maritime doctrine in Ottawa at the time. But it was also building confidence in the public understanding of what we were doing. And that links back to the media seizing on these ideas that the Navy was incapable of handling this. The fear-mongering in some quarters that we were sending, that it was suicidal, in fact, in terms of sending ships off there without any capability. And so we took steps early on to bring forward presentations to retired military to apprise them of what we were trying to achieve, what we were going to achieve, and what capabilities these ships were going to be sent off with when they finally departed for the Persian Gulf. And that paid off both in terms of giving retired people who had been spent their lives in the Navy, for example, an ability to talk with a fair amount of knowledge and confidence when the media was coming after them trying to look for, quote, a negative story, what I would call a negative story. The other obstacle to deploying successfully, and when I say successfully, I mean with good morale, confidence back home that these forces were going off well prepared. And a key part of that was the family understanding of what the servicemen and women were going to be expected to do. And therefore we took steps to have, through the family support centers, family briefings. The Associate Minister of Defense came down and spoke to families. She was fully apprised of the capabilities and what we were doing at the time. And so Minister Collins was quite effective in helping us build the confidence of the families with respect to what the servicemen and women were going to face. And, of course, the other obstacle to being successful in this whole thing was that of sustainability, and how long could we sustain the forces out there without some major activity and resupply and forward operating base that could be used for support of the forces. And tied into that sustainability, of course, was the question in the minds of the families is how long this whole thing is going to take. And that was a million-dollar question. But what I did attempt to do early on was to indicate that there would be efforts to relieve those forces out there after a given time. that opened up a whole new challenge for us, because although on the surface one might deduce that it would be just a simple case of refitting another three ships with equipment like we had done on these, in this instance. But our other tanker, in fact, was in refit, and after examination, it was obvious that she couldn't be made ready in a reasonable time for this operation, which then gave rise to the idea of troop rotations. And I say troop rotations, meaning crew rotations for the ships that were in the Persian Gulf. Now, that was kind of foreign to most people in the Navy, because we had bred a dedication to one ship that was strong and was quite functional in terms of morale, in terms of building morale, keeping morale high, and to suggest to someone that they were going to leave their ship to someone else's care was a bit of a challenge.